I'd like to welcome you to our second to last Tuesday Cafe, sponsored by the Ada-Lot Foundation. And today we're enjoying a presentation from one of our resident chemists, Christopher Graves. And I'm Jamie Thomas, I'm from the Linguistics Department, and it's been a real pleasure to bring together different faculty over these two semesters to delight us and surprise us and regale us in their tales about research failure. And what's been really interesting over the course of this year, working with my partners on this series, Rachel Burma and Tim Burke, is to consider all the many ways that the research process flows throughout the faculty life cycle. And what we've learned from faculty across rank, across department, across program, and even in interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary research, is that research is a process of discovery, and it has its ups and downs. And so next time we're together, we will get a chance to have some lunch and also learn from one of our economists, Daifeng He. But today is all about chemistry. And the last thing I want to sort of share with you is that today also happens to be Equal Pay Day. All right. And so today you might see I'm wearing my red, all right, in celebration of Equal Pay Day around the world. And I just want to share something with all of you, that Equal Pay Day is about raising awareness about the gender wage gap that continues to persist throughout the United States and in countries around the world. And the most recent figures show that women earn 80 cents on the dollar of their male colleagues, and this is according to the Institute of Women's Policy Research. And that gap is more pronounced for Black and Hispanic women, who earn 63 cents and 54 cents, respectively, on the dollar of their white male colleagues. So I share that with you. I'm not exactly sure about our situation here at Swarthmore, but it certainly bears talking about that we would be good to be in solidarity with Equal Pay Day celebrators around the world. All right, with that being said, I welcome Christopher Graves.
Thank you, Jane, and thank you all for coming. And Amy, thank you for reminding me why I became a chemist and not a biologist. So I'm going to talk today a little bit about how I think about research and how I run my research program, and sort of a little bit of philosophy to start with. So my first, I really enjoyed how Nat started her talk by showing us these beautiful pictures of the poets gazing into space. And so I wanted to ask some of you today, when you hear the word chemist, what do you think of?
Beakers.
I meant more people. People who are chemists. Who do you think of when you think of chemists?
People
who are beakers. There is beaker. Very well done. So I'll start here with some caricatures of scientists, chemists, engineers, mad people, crazy lunatics, people who took us back into the future. And then from popular culture, other madmen who use chemistry to do no good, and sort of my most offensive person on the slide in my mind is someone who can do magic with chemistry. So if you've ever watched CSI, forensic scientists who shoot things into instruments and get answers that are just unbelievable, and that's because they are unbelievable in the way that they have conducted their research. And I think that sort of this, together from popular culture, it's led to sort of a viewpoint of what we do in a chemistry building is haphazardly throwing things together, hoping things succeed, not wearing goggles while we do so. That really has left sort of a vague sense of what a chemist is. So, and then this is my most philosophical slide. So when I think of a chemist, I think of sort of two people who are sort of luminaries, obviously, in the field. So Madame Curie and Linus Pauling, both of whom won two Nobel Prizes. They change the way we think about things. So they discover processes, they push the boundaries of science, they gave us models for thinking about molecules and thinking about the way that molecules react and behave in nature. So how many of you have taken organic chemistry? No, we're all organic people. So So not a lot, but if you remember tetrahedral carbon, you could think Linus Pauling, so giving you that model. And of course, chemists aren't all white people, which all of the slides have shown us. Chemistry is a very diverse field, so here's a picture of Marie Daly, who was the first African-American woman to earn her PhD in chemistry from Columbia in 1957. So chemists are also trailblazers and mentors and inspirational people. And so here are two of my inspirations, Greg Hillhouse. So when I started when I was done going through grad school and was thinking about becoming a professor as a gay chemist, Greg was really the person who was, at that time, to my knowledge, the only person who was very out and very who he was in conducting his research. So he sort of pushed the boundaries of, in my mind, what I was able to do from that viewpoint. And then my good friend, Madeleine Joullier, who on equal pay day, this is a great sort of true thing to put her up. She's a 91-year-old chemist who's still active at Penn, was the first woman in a tenure track R1 position in organic chemistry, and really is a trailblazer. And so these are my personal trailblazers and personal role models. Okay, so this still leaves us with the question is, what do chemists do? What are we interested in? So what do we do when we go into lab and we think about problems? So I have another throwback to Jean Vincent, who talked about buildings in Paris, and specifically the machines who went in to make those buildings. So I'm gonna start my analogy with the Paris Opera House, which is a beautiful building that serves either a beautiful or a boring purpose, depending on where you sit on opera. And to make that building, we have a variety of building materials that go into turning it into something beautiful, and to make that be accomplished, we have a variety of machines to help us take those building materials and turn them into something like this. You, of course, can make different types of buildings. You can make buildings with totally different functions. You can do energy harvesting. We can make buildings that house people where people live. And then we can think about having buildings that have to act together and function in a sort of more macro sense, pulling all of their different functions together so people can live in cities. Okay, so I'm a chemist, so I'm not building buildings, but we can sort of use that analogy in the same way. So as chemists, we have a variety of building blocks and building materials. We have things like sugar, so this is glucose. We have a variety of elements in their elemental form from the periodic table. Carbon dioxide, these are alkenes, so specific types of compounds that have functional groups or bonding between atoms that allow for different distributions of electrons. That's as chemicky as it gets. And then nitrogen gas. And so as chemists, we take these building blocks and we transform them. So we can also make beautiful structural motifs that have a very specific purpose. So here's vancomycin. We can take simple molecules and we can convert them into functional molecules. And so these are types of plastics. So the polymer industry. We can take our building blocks of life and turn them into enzymes and other biomolecules. We can convert simple molecules into fertilizers, which really have sustained the human population on Earth. And then we can take elements and turn them into specific types of materials. And so this is the magnetic material that's in wind turbines. It is responsible for allowing you to harvest energy. And just like in buildings, we also have machines that help us do this type of chemistry. And so we have these, you'll have to forgive me, I'm a molecular chemist, so my interest is in molecules, and so all of my machines are molecules. So I have these machines here that we can use that can take these starting materials and turn them into these useful types of materials. And this is really what I'm interested in. I'm interested in making new machines that make new types of materials and accomplish different types of reactions. And I will highlight that every one of these machines I put up there has won a Nobel Prize at some point in history. Okay, so my research program really is focused on making catalysts and making, that's sort of the more chemical term for the machine in the context that I put it in. So who's heard the word catalyst before? And what do you think of when you think of a catalyst? What does a catalyst do?
Yeah.
Get something going. What else?
Causes a reaction.
Go ahead.
It's not directly altered by the reaction.
Yeah, very good. You could pass the Chem 10 quiz. So a catalyst, as they said, is something that accomplishes a reaction. And so if we start here as our green cartoony catalyst, this is our starting point. You'll notice that throughout this reaction, every time we cycle through here, we get the catalyst back, so the catalyst isn't used. The catalyst accomplishes the reaction, spits out product at the end. To think about what a catalyst actually does in a chemical sense, it accomplishes sort of two broad fundamental things. It pulls reacting species, in this case A and B, together. And when it does that, it changes the way those molecules, the sort of ground states of those molecules. When it puts them in close proximity, it can also perform bond making and bond breaking on those species to make the bonds in the product. So break bonds in starting materials, make bonds in products. And one of the ways it does that is by taking electrons, which are a subatomic particle, and either putting them into a bond or taking them out of the bond. Okay, good. So I'm interested in developing catalysts. And so some of the more successful catalysts, like your catalytic converter on your car, sort of most of the pictures of the machines that I put on the previous slide, come from metals that are down here. And they're highlighted in red, and they're what are called scarce elements or precious metals. They're things we don't have a lot of. And because we don't have a lot of them, they're very, very expensive. So I have a red equals this beautiful BMW. So there's a big push in chemistry, and certainly my research program is focused on ways of using these more abundant elements, elements that we have a lot of, that are more readily available, that therefore don't cost nearly as much money, and you can argue are more sustainable. And so here we have a price point difference of this nice toy car, which is blue. And these, I actually picked these cars based on their actual prices. So I'm an aluminum chemist. Aluminum costs about $2 a kilogram. Aluminum is up here in the blue. Platinum, which is one of the more successful catalytic materials, in red, costs about $40,000 a kilogram. And so we're talking about 4 to 5 times more expensive, orders of magnitude more expensive. Aluminum also has the benefit of that it's actually less toxic than some of the more heavy metals, and so that also accomplishes an important goal. So I'm interested in developing aluminum complexes that can do these types of catalytic reactions. So let's just talk very briefly about what it is we might want aluminum to be able to do. And so we have an aluminum metal here. We have, this is the hydrogen molecule. There is a bond between these two H atoms, and that bond has 2 electrons in it. So we might want the aluminum to interact with that hydrogen and break that bond. To do that, the aluminum gives electrons. It puts 2 electrons, takes 2 electrons from itself and gives it to the hydrogen molecule. And then we can transfer that hydrogen away from aluminum. It can, in this case, we make an alcohol. We have a compound that can take those hydrogens off. And in this reaction, you actually dump the electrons back into aluminum. So what we're seeing here is we break bonds by moving electrons. We make bonds by moving electrons. The problem with that is that aluminum doesn't move electrons. It is +3. Almost ubiquitously +3. So this is a big problem, and my entire research program focuses on overcoming this issue. So again, inspired by Nat Anderson, I wrote a poem to put this in context. And so my poem is, roses are red, violets are blue, aluminum won't give up me electrons, what do I do? You can argue that it is also probably good I didn't become a poet instead of a chemist, because it's not a very good poem, but I do strike the poet pose much better than I write poetry. So what do we do to overcome this? And so I've been very metal focused so far in my talk, right? I'm talking about aluminum and what aluminum can do, but I'm a coordination chemist, and what coordination chemistry means is you take a metal, and then you have a lot of organic-y things around for the ride that coordinate to that metal, and that changes the way the metal behaves. Well, if we think about using a ligand or organic molecule that has the ability to give up electrons and take up electrons, you can generate a complex that overcomes this problem. And so I put this Pac-Man-y type thing in here. So we break the hydrogen bond. That ligand gives up the electrons. The metal is intimately involved. It bonds the hydrogens. And then when we transfer off that hydrogen, the ligand accepts those electrons again. And this is really the crux of my research program. So to put it in more in this stance, we keep a stable oxidation state of the ligand. Electrons don't change, sorry, the electrons don't change at the metal. They do change at the ligand. We use those things together. Okay, so I went to a talk once where the professor started by giving a picture of a bridge covered in fog, and I'm going to use the same analogy they used when they described what it's like doing research in the chemistry lab. And that is, you think you have a plan, you sort of know where maybe the bridge is going, but you really don't know. You have a vague outline of a tree that you hope is the tree you want to find, and we're going to walk this crooked path along, and hopefully we're going to figure out where this leads, and it's going to lead us to where we want to go. Okay, so I know not the majority of you are scientists, and so in the science field, it's very common to work with students, and so I have, these are the students, current sophomore students who are in my group, who all of the chemistry that I really am not going to talk to you about today, they've done. So I very rarely actually go in and mix chemicals together anymore, except in similar circumstances when I mix certain materials. So you can thank them for my success. All right, so I got this tweet from that was on Twitter, sort of perfect time for when I'm planning this talk of how science works, and it's a series of failures followed by minimal successes spaced out in between. And I'm going to push back a little bit on this. And so Sarah, in one of the first ones of these I went to, really put it the way I like it, is research fail is misleading. I think I like research evolution more, in that we learn from our mistakes, and our project evolves around those mistakes and those learning opportunities that we have. And that's really what I'm going to share with you today and talk about. Okay, so how do we do that? So for me, my research process really starts by scribbling down ideas. So this is a picture of my bulletin board in my office of random things I've thought about throughout my day, if I go to meetings, when I should be preparing course notes, things of that nature. These are ideas I have from reading, from talking to my husband, who's also a chemistry professor. Good times at home, and thinking about the science that I want to do, thinking about overcoming this fundamental problem of the removal. So then I give my students some ideas, I give them specific reactions to go in to do, we come up with a plan, and so this is actually a picture from a notebook I kept when I was a postdoc. I don't know why I have pictures on this on my computer, but I do, so here they are. We come up with a research plan, so this is sort of the outline of the reaction that I wanted to do. I write out the chemical reaction, and then I actually go into lab, my students go into lab, and we actually carry this plan out and we take notes about what happened and keep track of things. And so these are pictures from my research group of actual synthetic apparatus we use. And so everything I do is actually sensitive to water and sensitive to oxygen, and so we use some pretty fun pieces of equipment that get rid of those things. And so this is my glove box, which, as the name suggests, has big gloves on it. Put your hands in, and you do chemistry in these vessels. And this is my Schlenk line, where we can pump all of the oxygen out of our reacting vessels. So my students go in, they mix some chemicals together, the plan that we have, and we make something, which is this brown gunk. So maybe that isn't what we want. We go back to the drawing board, we rethink our synthetic strategy, we go back into lab and we make some new things, and so now we have a beautiful yellow material, which is what I want. Yellow's great in this case. And so, and this is really iterative, so you go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, figuring out what you've made at each stage and if you've gotten closer to what your goals are. And then another important part of this is grant writing. So we write a lot of grants in the physical sciences because chemistry is expensive. They don't give glove boxes away on the side of the street. And so sort of taking our ideas and our results then accumulates both in publications and grant proposals when we put them forward. Okay, so what is this yellow salt? So we make something. We have an idea, we have a vague idea of what this compound is because we've written down some notes and we've put certain chemicals in. So we aren't going about this totally blind, but some of the fun in doing synthetic chemistry is figuring out what you've made, right? So my favorite detective, Angela Lansbury, better known as Jessica Fletcher, can figure out, help. We act as a detective to figure out what our compounds are. And so we have a lot of analytical tools that we use, and it's sort of like a puzzle when you put all the pieces together. And so we can do nuclear magnetic resonance, which gives us a variety of information. We can do X-ray diffraction, which gives us other pieces of information, elemental analysis, CDVis, electrochemistry. And this, for me, is the most important one. We'll see a few of these as we go forward, which tells us if electrons are going into, which are up or out of our compounds. And so we have a direct measure of how the electrons are actually moving, which is important for us. So when you pull, we also do a lot of modeling of our compounds. So when you pull all of this together, that yellow powder turns into this figure, which tells us we have an aluminum that has these organic molecules bound to it. Okay. And so I'm going to go through, in very little detail, some sort of an arc of a project that I started when I started my independent career. But to do that, I sort of have to tell you a specific type of organic molecule we're looking at for its redox properties, which is called a diamine. This is an imine, and there's two of them, so that's where the name comes from. And then the important electronic states are here, where you can have no electrons added, one electron added, two electrons. So in theory, if you put an aluminum here, you have the ability to add two electrons and ultimately take two electrons away. Okay, so when I started, the first thing we did is we tried to make aluminum compounds of all three oxidation states. And so here is a picture of the first student who worked in my group, a picture of all of his notebooks and all of his spectral that came with it. And we published a paper on synthesis and characterization of these over multiple oxidation states, which literally had three compounds in it. So that's going to become important. Good success per notebook. So I guess there was a lot of fail, succeed. And we do things multiple times, so I'm making it seem worse than everybody is. But he made both a compound with one electron added and a compound with two electrons added. So somebody, and I forget who, in the February series asked, well, why don't we publish results when they don't work? And my answer to that is, well, we just do it very strategically. And so here's a line from this paper. It says, attempts to prepare aluminum complexes with neutral ligands were unsuccessful, and then I spell all the things I tried and all the ways they failed. So I do try when I write papers to highlight some of what I view the more important failures, in that if we're really trying to make three different things and we've only made two of them, I think you have to talk about why you don't have the other one there, and what you tried to do to help to do that. And for the reviews of this paper actually were really good, and that reviewers really appreciated that I spelled out all the ways we were unable to make something. So, all right, so with this system, I used to be a uranium chemist. As a postdoc, I made uranium compounds. And something you needed to worry about with uranium is access to metal. And so you used these compounds that put a lot of material in the way of the metal to protect it. So I was sort of thinking the same way about aluminum, which turns out was not correct. So what we thought is, well, let's just chop all of this stuff off of the ligands. Let's just get rid of it all together. When you do that, you can make the neutral ligand complex. Here, so this is the third piece of our goal. And so we have now no electrons added in this system, just by taking those groups off of the aromatic ring. And so our things we've learned here, sort of our failures led to our successful synthesis of this complex. Now Connor, my sort of second student to work on this project, this paper also had three structures in it, but a lot more reactivity, and he did it in two notebooks, so things are getting a little bit better. All right, and then sort of the final piece of this arc is something we're very much interested in is not just can we add and remove electrons from our complex, but can we add them and remove them at energies we want to be able to add and remove them for? So can we tune our compounds to be able to put electrons in and take electrons out? And so most recently, Henry has worked on derivatives of the compounds Connor made, where he put a variety of different R groups in this position of the ring of the organic part of the complex. And we recently published this, and so this is the most recent publication from the group, where now he has 1.5 notebooks which have 11 compounds in this paper, and it's 14 pages long. So things have gotten better, and we figured some things out with this. And we did accomplish our goal, and so here we have a black line which shows sort of the parent compound. If we add specific groups, we can shift to the red. If we add other specific groups, we can shift in the other direction to the blue. So the conclusion there is that we can indeed tune the electronics in this. Okay, that was the story arc. We started by walking over a bridge that's very cloudy, foggy. We don't know where we're going, and this is the bridge we're on now. We still don't actually know where we're going, but at least the bridge looks clearer and safer, and you know, there's some pretty trees in the direction. But what if we're on the wrong damn bridge? So I've picked a bridge, and I'm walking on this bridge, and it could actually lead nowhere to where I want the bridge to go. So in my group, and I think in most groups, we don't just take one bridge. We take multiple bridges simultaneously. So another project that I work on that I'm not going into much detail about looks at a different type of ligand base. And so instead of looking at diamines, in this case we're looking at NO groups here, where that bond also exists over three oxidation states. Can we make these complexes that have this ability to accept and donate electrons? And so a quick story arc here. We started by making these complexes, which have one, and each ligand has one point of contact. And so this is bad electrochemical data. And so we go down, we can take electrons out, that's great, but you'll notice when we go back that the up and the down do not equal one another, and that is not good. So yes, we can take electrons out, no, we cannot put those electrons back in. So we did a ligand redesign, we got much more beautiful electrochemistry now. We have more arms that are bound to the aluminum ion, more NO groups, and now we take electron out, we take another electron out, and we put both electrons back in. So the up and down are about the same. Success. But we made a compound that has a lot of points of contact around the metal ion. And so what we find is we actually can't do multi-electron chemistry with these complexes because we've taken all the space around the metal ion up. So one of my students this summer is going to sort of go with, I hope, what will be the Goldilocks case, where we hit it just right, and we have the right number of points of contact that leave some space for the reaction to occur. Okay, so that was my research program, and I'm gonna end with pictures of my kid because I have two. So the question is, what does a future chemist look like? And here's Freddie when I brought him to campus the other day, and if you look closely at his shirt, it has brown bottoms and flasks and chemistry and all these lovely things written on it. But if I'm being perfectly honest, he's probably more interested in building buildings because that crane really was the highlight of his trip to campus. So great, thanks, and I'll happily answer any questions.